exactly the same time that the Italian Renaissance was just getting started down in Italy, papal prestige took a sudden collapse and tumble in Europe, starting in the early 14th century. The high point of papal prestige was certainly in the first quarter of the 13th century. But in 1309, a Frenchman was elected to the papacy. Now, he happened to be up in France at the time, and as he headed toward Rome, he only got as far as the city of Avignon on the Rhone River, or in the Rhone Valley, and there he simply settled down. He never went to Rome at all. And this began a period that lasted almost 70 years. It's known as the Babylonian captivity of the papacy. Because basically what happened was that the French Pope appointed a series of French cardinals, and when he died, they elected again a French Pope. And for almost 70 years, popes did not go down to Rome at all. There was one short visit. And indeed, this meant that other countries, England and so on, considered the papacy to be simply a pawn of the French monarch. And this began a very disastrous decline then of papal prestige throughout Europe. Now, it went along with some other causes of complaint against the church in general. For one thing, a whole series of customs had grown up slowly within the church. Notably, for instance, the series of seven sacraments, and out of those seven, five of them were absolutely necessary to salvation. You had to be baptized, you had to have communion, you had to do confession, you had to be confirmed in the church, and you had to have final unction. There are two others of the seven. Those, of course, are ordination into the priesthood and marriage. But actually, you don't have to be a priest or married to be saved. But the other five are necessary. And it meant, in fact, that the concept grew up that Christians did not have direct contact with God, but their contact with God is through the priesthood. In other words, there is an intermediary between the parishioner and God himself. And along with this grew up that troublesome factor that clerics are, of course, used in not only the church bureaucracy, but also in the bureaucracy of the monarchs and the great lords, because they're essentially the only persons who can read and write. Now, in order to pay them, they were given benefices, that is, positions in the church. So they got the income from certain church offices. But, of course, they did not do the church offices themselves because they're busy being bureaucrats. The result was that they would hire a poor priest to do the services in this particular parish for them. Now, those priests got only a tiny pittance out of the sum that came in. They were frequently poorly educated. And the result was that they very often tried to make up the difference in pay by selling the sacraments. In other words, if you wanted your child to be baptized, you paid cash for it. If you wanted final unction, you paid cash. If you wanted to be married, of course you paid cash. And so on. Now this, of course, with the poor, rubbed very hard against the grain. And there was a great deal of discontent with this concept of particularly pluralism, because very often the same person within the church held a whole series of benefices scattered around Europe. And along with this, there was discontent at higher levels, because here there was such an enormous amount of money that seemed always to flood into the coffers of the church, not into the coffers of the monarch. There were all kinds of special taxes. Not only did the church own lands and estates itself, but also, of course, there was a tithe. One-tenth of all things produced went to the clergy, to the church. There were special taxes, such as Peter's pence paid in northern kingdoms, and other special taxes, such as when an archbishop or a bishop died and was replaced, all of the income for the first year went to the papacy. This is called the first fruits. And so a lot of monarchs complained that, in fact, out of the revenues of the kingdom, that more than half of it was going to the church and not to them, and that they needed it. So there's dissatisfaction on the top, and there's dissatisfaction on the bottom. And when the Babylonian captivity took place, and they figured that all of this was redounding to the credit and the coffers of France, needless to say, other countries, particularly England and Germany to a degree, were pretty restive under this. They began simply to rebel against papal concepts and papal restrictions. Now finally, in 1377, a pope did actually move back to Rome. He was encouraged in this by a general outcry against the residents in Avignon, but also by a formidable lady, St. Catherine of Siena. She is one of the very formidable lady saints of this period, a woman who knew exactly what was right, what was proper, and saw to it that it was done. On one occasion, when she was tramping across Italy, she found two small armies lined up prepared to do battle. And St. Catherine didn't believe in that kind of nonsense. It was unchristian. She marched right between the two armies and said, "Now, stop this. Go home." And they went home. A very formidable lady. And she marched herself all the way up to Avignon and said to the Pope, "You don't belong here. You belong back in Rome. Now, pack up." In fact, he did in due time pack up and move down to Rome. Now, Rome, when he moved back, was of course a state of disaster. The papacy had not been there for 70 years, and the town had been taken over by rival noble factions, particularly the Orsini and the Colonna, who were fighting for control of the city. Various towns that were part of the papal states had simply fallen away and into the hands of nobles who established tyrannies. And the old papal palace at the Lateran had fallen into such a state of decay that the popes had to start building a new palace, and this is when they started building the Palace of the Vatican, which they move into after this. But the pope who moved down there died the very next year. And the result was that the College of Cardinals had to meet and elect a new pope. And they were French cardinals as a whole. They would undoubtedly have elected a Frenchman as pope, except that the people of Rome, in a mob, broke into the room they were sitting in and demanded that they elect an Italian pope. So they did. And after they had recovered from the shock of this, they moved quietly south of Rome to Anagni, all 16 of them, and met there and sent a pronouncement out to the world that they had only elected this man as pope under duress and under physical threat. Therefore, they considered this election to be improper, and they proceeded to elect another man, a bishop of Geneva, as pope in his place. That starts that horrid event called the Great Schism. Because while they and the Bishop of Geneva moved back to Avignon, the pope they had elected first stayed right on as pope in Rome. So we now had two popes, one in Rome and one in Avignon. And as you might expect, the various nations of Europe tended to recognize one or the other depending on what political advantage it gave them. This did nothing for the prestige of the papacy. Now, there was hope, of course, that eventually, when these popes died, that this could be regularized. And indeed, eventually, when the French pope died, the cardinals up there elected a Spaniard as pope, and they made him promise that indeed he would step down if there were a chance of reconciliation. In the meantime, he went off to Spain. And the Italian refused to give up, even the new one. And finally, in 1412, a council of church officials met at Pisa, where they elected a new pope, hoping that the other two would now resign. Not at all. What happened was we now had three popes instead of two. One in Spain, one in Avignon, one in Rome. The prestige dropped even further, as you might guess from this. And the result of this was a total scandal throughout all of Europe. There now were general demands everywhere that something be done to put an end to this ridiculous situation. And the result of this was the calling of the Great Council of Constance in 1415. Now, that council was called primarily to deal with the problem of papacy. And they asked, in fact, each of the three popes to agree to appear before it and to agree to accept the decision of the Council of Constance. Now, the Frenchman agreed at last. The Roman pope agreed, as long with the proviso that he be recognized as having been the proper pope in the proper line of the papacy. The Spanish pope refused to answer at all. However, the Council of Constance did meet, and they did elect a new pope. Now, both the Roman pope and the Frenchman stepped down. Basically, this ended the schism because nobody paid any more attention to the Spaniard, and when he died off, it was the end of that. The papacy did return then to Rome, and that becomes the direct line. However, a little later in the 15th century, a dissident group of cardinals again left Rome and tried to elect a schismatic pope. That one failed to take hold, in actual fact, but it meant that up to about the mid-century, the 15th century, the papacy was in deep trouble. They could not be active to any major degree simply because of this schism within the papacy. So it is only after about 1450 that the papacy begins to recover. Okay. Now, while all this has been going on, it has been bearing bitter fruit in Northern Europe. For one thing, up in England, in the period of around 1380, the English crown was particularly irritated at sending, of course, any revenues to the French papacy. So they had formed an alliance with a theologian who was working at Oxford, a man named John Wycliffe, W-Y-C-L-I-F-F-E. And John Wycliffe, indeed, wrote a series of tracts which insisted, for instance, that governments owed allegiance to the church only as long as the church was righteous in nature, and that the persons who should decide whether the church was righteous in nature or not were, of course, the monarchs. Now, that was highly attractive to the English kings, as you might expect. The result was that they stopped paying a certain number of taxes into the papacy, and so on, and they were delighted with John Wycliffe. But unfortunately, John Wycliffe didn't stop at this point. He then proceeded to get into theological discussions and concepts that were, in fact, heretical. One of these was the belief that, in fact, all true Christians had direct access to God, and he commissioned preachers who were not members of the priesthood to go around and preach the word of God in villages. More dangerously still, he attacked the great central doctrine of transubstantiation. I'm sorry, but you're going to have to know something about this one. It's going to hang on for a couple of lectures or more for you. This is the theory of the mystery of the Mass in the church. The concept of the Mass was this, that at the moment the host, this is the wafer, is elevated in the Mass, it becomes, in fact, the body of Christ, and that the wine used in the Mass becomes the blood of Christ. This is a literal transformation, and this means that the sacrifice of Christ is re-celebrated every time Mass is held. Now, this is the doctrine of transubstantiation. And what Wycliffe said was basically this, that as far as he could see, the wafer remained a wafer of unleavened bread, and the wine remained wine. It did not change into the blood and the body of Christ. So he decided that, in fact, the miracle of transubstantiation did not take place, but instead what really happened was something that he called consubstantiation. And that is that at this moment, the Spirit of Christ enters into the wine and the wafer, but it is not literally changed. And he argues that the change is like this, that if you take a bar of iron, it is hard, heavy, cold, and so on, and you can heat the bar of iron. Now this adds something to the bar of iron that wasn't there before, but the iron remains iron. Now in the same way with the wafer and the wine, you have added the Spirit of Christ, but it remains wine and the wafer. Okay? Now this was immediately, of course, criticized as being rank heresy. Wycliffe was condemned, but he is protected by the monarch. Now, in fact, Wycliffe's ideas tended to die down in England. They almost disappear. They become highly unpopular after that peasant revolt of 1381. Wycliffe himself is never punished. He dies a natural death. But what is to the point here is that Richard II, who is the king just at this time, is married to a princess from Bohemia, what we would call Czechoslovakia today. And she came to England with a train of scholars, including a theologian from the University of Prague named John Huss. And Huss became extremely excited about Wycliffe's ideas, so that when he returned to Prague, he took those ideas back to Prague with him. Now, I might add that Wycliffe had already done a translation of the Bible into English on the theory that the Bible ought to be available in their own native language to all believers. So when Huss went back to Prague, he began preaching Wycliffe's ideas. He preached consubstantiation. He preached, in fact, a whole series of Wycliffe's own sermons, of which he had copies. And he also preached the concept of direct communion with God, all of these factors. Now, this took hold in Prague to an extreme degree. A large part of the university took it up. A great many of the people resident in Prague accepted the ideas of John Huss. And the church was, of course, outraged. So what the church demanded was that he appear before the Council of Constance. This is the other thing that was main item on the agenda of that council. The Holy Roman Emperor gave John Huss a pass which was supposed to allow him to attend the council and return freely to Prague, regardless of what the decision was. A safe conduct pass is what it is. Huss went down to appear before the Council of Constance, and he never, in fact, got much of a hearing. He appeared before the council. He was accused of being a heretic. When he tried to defend himself, the council itself simply started booing and hissing and catcalling and stamping their feet, so that no one was ever allowed to hear what his defense was. He was condemned as a heretic, turned over to the local government, and was burned at the stake. His ashes were thrown into the Rhine River. Now, that did not end the Hussite rebellion. The Hussites, indeed, maintained themselves, and they, in fact, split up into a conservative and a liberal wing, or a radical wing. The radical wing split off and took up the concept of earliest Christianity. And this was that all property should be owned communally. That is, community ownership of all property, of all articles of work, result of all labor. They themselves tried to live this out, but eventually were attacked by the conservative Hussites and were destroyed there. But the one thing that the conservative Hussites finally achieved was to be welcomed back into the church, but uniquely, they were allowed communion in both kinds. If you know the normal communion, in Catholicism, the parishioner gets the wafer, but not the wine. The priest gets the wine. Uniquely, the Hussites in Prague, or the Catholics there, were granted communion, the wine as well as the wafer. And they retained that as a special privilege until the mid-17th century. So there are, in fact, signs of deep rebellion in the northern part of Europe against the church as an organization. They were rebelling against various practices, against various aspects. You might note that most of these are concerned with what we call usage. These are technical terms, and I've got to try to define them so you understand them, and you must, otherwise the Reformation is going to make no sense to you at all. In the church, you have doctrine and you have usage. Now, that exists today. Doctrine are those things which you must believe in order to achieve salvation. You have no choice on these whatsoever. Anything else is heretical. On the other hand, there are a whole lot of things that go on in the church which are just usage. That is, people have done it this way for centuries. Those can be criticized because this is not a matter of doctrine. I'll give you a perfect example of what I mean by this. The celibacy of the priesthood is not doctrine, it is usage. Priests, indeed, were allowed to marry in the church up to about the 8th century, and it was stopped about that time. Now, there is no doctrine about that. It remains up for argument today. And the criticism that you read on this score in papers periodically nowadays is technically possible because this is not opposition to doctrine, but only to usage. You can always argue usage, but never doctrine. Now, this is a technical point. And what most of these persons were opposing was usage, not doctrine. It still irritated the church, which did not like to be criticized on any grounds whatsoever. It still irritates the church, which does not like to be criticized on any grounds whatsoever. This is one of the standard things that does go on. However, this became increasingly common. And into this whole picture now comes humanism. Now, last time you saw what Italian humanism was about. And a series of northerners began going down to Italy, particularly to Florence, to study. And among these, for instance, were some Englishmen, and they went down to Florence, learned Greek, and carried the knowledge of Greek back to England. And you had at Oxford and London then a whole little group of English humanists that appeared on the scene. Collett, Lineker, eventually Sir Thomas More, is one of these figures. You had a German who went down to Florence and studied with that Platonic Academy, a man named Reuchlin. And Reuchlin became extremely interested down in Florence at the Platonic Academy in the study of Hebrew. Indeed, one of the major Italian scholars in Florence, Pico della Mirandola, was a major scholar of Hebrew and had read a great many works. He had a sizable library in Hebrew, in fact. And Reuchlin became interested in this from Pico della Mirandola. He went back to Germany, and there he continued both the study and the teaching of Hebrew. What he was interested in, of course, was trying to understand the Old Testament in the language in which it had been written, rather than the Latin translation. And he felt that in order to understand the Old Testament, you must have a full knowledge of the language it was written in, of Hebrew. So he founded Hebrew Studies. Now, he ran foul of the Dominican order. The Dominicans, all through this period, are going to be the ultra-conservatives. And the Dominicans were dead set against Hebrew, dead set against Jews, as far as that was concerned, also. So They, Reuchlin insisted that Hebrew should be studied in universities, that there should be chairs of Hebrew as well as of Greek. The Dominicans insisted, on the other hand, that all books written in Hebrew ought to be burned. All of them. Not only should it not be studied, they should burn them all. When there was no Hebrew, maybe you could finally get the Jews to convert to Christianity where they belong. It was to be a losing idea all the way. But he did manage to make life absolute hell for poor Reuchlin for many years. In the long run, Reuchlin was to be successful. That is, Hebrew did become studied and was taken over. So that what you have here, occurring with Reuchlin, and we'll look at another instance in a minute, is an attempt to go back to the beginnings of things. Now, this is exactly what the Italian humanists were doing in their own way by going back to classical literature. Reuchlin wants to go back to study the Bible in its original form. In the same way, the humanists in the North devoted themselves primarily to studies of early Christianity, rather than to medieval Christianity. It is notable that up in England, Collett, for instance, preached a series of sermons on the subject of St. Paul's epistles from the Bible. Now, this was not the sort of thing that was ever done. What he did was to preach things out of medieval scholasticism. Now he goes back to the source, and what's more, he tries to see Paul not in terms of simply Christian ideas, but of a Christian man living in a particular age and confronted with historical problems in the growth and birth of Christianity. In other words, an historical view of St. Paul. Now, this was an extraordinarily radical kind of move, and he was influential on a whole series of other humanists. Sir Thomas More, who becomes an important figure at the court of Henry VIII, of course, is a follower of Collett's. And a young man came over from the Netherlands, a young man named Erasmus, who was a major scholar there. He knew his Latin. He didn't know any Greek. He had already published a small book of Latin adages, and he had a reputation of being enormously wise and also a wit. He arrived in London and begins to meet the humanists, and eventually at a dinner he meets Sir Thomas More. They haven't been introduced, but they are deep in conversation in Latin, needless to say. And in the middle of all of this rather bright talk, Erasmus says to More, "You must be More or nobody," which happens to be a Latin pun, as it works out, nullus as opposed to more, more or nothing. And More replied, "And you must be Erasmus or the devil." So they became very close friends immediately. And indeed, it is Sir Thomas More who says to him, "You know, kid, you're never going to get anywhere bright as you are unless you learn Greek. This you've got to have. You're bright, you're charming, but if you really want to get on the ball, learn Greek." So Erasmus now studies Greek. He's later to teach Greek. In fact, at Cambridge, he teaches Greek for a while. And he begins to write enormously. But one of the great jobs he takes up is to print a great publication of the Greek New Testament. Because, of course, the New Testament, unlike the Old, was written in Greek originally. It was written in Koine Greek, which was... Koine Greek is a kind of merchant Greek. As compared to classical Greek, it's a little like pidgin English compared to English. And it is a little unnerving if you have studied classical Greek to read the New Testament, because you constantly find God saying, "You go do this now, chop, chop," sort of thing. And it is anything but elegant in diction. Nonetheless, this is the language it's written in. And so Erasmus now gets together all of the oldest and the best manuscripts he can to produce the best possible copy of the New Testament. You must understand that while there are lots of copies of the New Testament and of the Old Testament and so on, that these weren't always very good. These had been copied for 1,000 years by hand. And if you have ever tried copying anything several thousand pages long by hand, you do get tired at times. Sometimes you leave a word out, sometimes you skip 2 lines, sometimes you repeat a line twice. All kinds of errors creep into things. And the result is that after 1,000 years of compounded errors, the copies that were extant were not too good always. So the main job now is to get as accurate as possible a copy and to publish it. And this is what Erasmus does, is to publish the New Testament now in Greek. Now all of this, again, is a part of this going back to exactly this same period that Italian humanists are interested in, but only in Christian aspects.
In his book, The Praise of Folly, first published in Paris in 1511, the humanist Erasmus presents his views on the
follies of mankind. Now, he is not opposed to folly as a whole. He thinks, in fact, that folly is one of the saving graces in mankind, and if it weren't for people being foolish part of the time, it would be a pretty sad world. Nonetheless, he delights in pointing out all the follies that exist. The follies of the rich, the follies of the powerful, the follies of the poor, and the follies of the church as well. He spares no one in this rather entertaining diatribe of his, and it becomes the bestseller in all of Europe. It is published all over the place. Everyone reads it, chortles, and delights in praise of folly. He writes a whole series of other works as well. But it is notable that he is careful only to attack usage. He doesn't go within spitting distance of doctrine. He isn't going to have any trouble with the church at all. And this is the normal position of the humanists. The humanists want, in fact, to purify the church as a whole. That is, they want to get rid of what they consider medieval superstition that has been added on. They want to return to the purer concepts of early Christianity. They want to do away with a lot of the money side of things in the church, all of these factors, but they do not want to tamper with faith itself in any way. In this they remain absolutely pure and to the cause itself. However, it establishes, of course, a lot of bickering going on about religious subjects. Now it's notable then that what you have in all of Northern Europe is a kind of religious ferment going on that simply never touches the Italian humanists at all. The Italian humanists just aren't interested in that bed. And while the Northern humanists indeed will read other classical literature, their heart remains true to Christian reform. This is where they are most interested. Indeed, they start new kinds of schools, particularly the Brethren of the Common Life, start a kind of schooling in which they operate on the theory that good deeds are important, simple living is important, learning is important, all of these factors. So you have a kind of break between what's going on in Italy and what's going on in the North. Now, while I call it the North, you must understand that it includes everything outside of Italy, including Spain. My world at this point is Italy and everything else, because even over in Spain, they produce a rather spectacular Bible, which has the Hebrew Old Testament, the Greek New Testament, the Vulgate Latin version, all in one spectacular edition. It's called the Complutensian Bible, and so on. So that this is the general position in the North. Now, what's going on in Italy is that the papacy is paying no attention to any of this. Because the late 15th century is, and the early 16th is the period usually called the age of the secular papacy. Now, this means that there are a series of popes who are acting, in fact, much more like secular rulers than they are like heads of the Christian church. They are more interested in power. They are more interested in their own families than in anything else. And indeed, they are often startling in what they say. Let me give you a couple examples of quotations from popes. There is a Sienese man called Aeneas Silvius Piccolomini, who is finally made Pope Pius II. Now, he had been a poet and a humanist scholar and a diplomat. He had, in fact, been in the church, but had avoided taking the orders of priesthood until he knew he was going to be elected pope. Only then did he do this, and his remark is perfect Italian humanism, but dubious Christianity. He says, "Ah, well, I guess I'm going to have to give up the worship of Venus and take up the worship of Bacchus. I will give up women and take up wine." It's not the sort of thing you expect to hear a pope say. It just isn't quite that. Or in the 16th century, when a Medici is elected Pope Leo X, he is a man who has enjoyed good living also. His remark is exquisitely smug. He says, "God has given us this, let us enjoy it." Now, that's what we mean by secular attitudes in the papacy. And indeed, this becomes something of a scandal, particularly in the most secular of all popes. This is Pope Alexander VI. Now, Alexander VI is a Spaniard. The family name is Borgia. They come from a famous Spanish family. And when he is elected to the papacy, it is quite simply because he buys it. Now, this is the sin of simony, which is forbidden by the church. But nonetheless, what he does is buy cardinals' votes, in fact, by promising them special positions, money, other factors like this. So he becomes the pope. And he too settles down to enjoy it. And it is notable that he is a good family man in his own way. He has three beautiful bastard children whom he brings with him to the courts of the Vatican and for whom he does the best possible. He gets them titles. The girl is Lucrezia Borgia, and he starts marrying her off. Now, of course, he starts marrying her off when she's about 15. This is before he is the pope. And he marries her off to a pleasant young nobleman, whom she rather likes, as a matter of fact. But then her father becomes the pope, and he decides this is not a good enough marriage for his daughter. So he annuls the marriage on the grounds that her husband is impotent. Now, that does irritate that young man to an extreme degree, with the result that he spends a great deal of time proving to the world that he's anything but for some time afterwards. But in the meantime, Lucrezia is married off to a new husband, a very charming young man of vastly higher status in the world, and she settles down with him quite happily. However, eventually, her father, and particularly her brother Cesare, decides that they can do better for her than this also. So Cesare hires assassins who in fact enter their bedroom, and her husband is stabbed to death, literally in the same bed with her, which is kind of rough on poor Lucrezia, but indeed she is then in fact married off spectacularly to the Duke of Ferrara of the famous family of D'Este, who are the oldest feudal lords in Italy in terms of lineage. It is a spectacularly good marriage, even for a pope's bastard. So she then, I know she has a ferocious name in legend of being a poisoner, a wicked woman. Not at all. She is simply a kind of sweet, dim-witted blonde who is pushed around her entire life. She's married to her last husband by the time she's 22 years old. She settles down to be a model of a virtuous wife from that time on. She never poisons anyone at all, in fact. This is all legendary. The evil member of the family is her brother, Cesare, who is ambitious. he also sees that his older brother is murdered to get him out of the way. And he becomes a general of the papal armies and an enormously ferocious one. He is the scourge of much of Italy with those armies. He is the model for Machiavelli's Prince, is indeed based on the life of Cesare Borgia. But as you can, I should think, begin to see, this kind of family life does not add an enormous amount of prestige to the papacy in this period. So that indeed for many Northerners, this begins to be a somewhat scandalous and scandalizing kind of court. All of this is going to add together then into a whole long series of dissatisfactions that take place. And it is this kind of dissatisfaction combined with this new idea of Northern humanism, of returning to the Bible itself for inspiration, not to medieval scholastic thought, that is going to all come together and create that famous event, the Protestant Reformation. And that is what I am going to do next time. So go away.